Hello and welcome to another episode of the Intangible Podcast. And today we're here with Donald Horowitz, a professor at Duke Law School and an expert in ethnicity. And I have to say, I heard about a Professor Horowitz when I was studying ethnicity in my class this semester at university. And I was a little dissatisfied with a lot of the literature, so my teaching fellow gave me Professor Horowitz's book, which we're going to talk about in the interview. And that really enlightened me. So I invited Professor Horowitz on, and he gratefully accepted. So I'm very excited to speak with him. And I guess my first question is a question that I ask a lot of guests who come on the Intangible Podcast, and that's for you, Professor Horowitz. What made you interested in studying ethnicity?
An accident, actually,
Sure.
and I want to recommend accidents as the way to decide on your future if the accident seems to make sense to you. I was a graduate student at Harvard in the political science department. And by the way, you said I teach at Duke Law School. First of all, I'm emeritus, so I'm not teaching anymore,
Okay.
but I'm both a political scientist and a lawyer, and was jointly appointed at Duke, so I was
Yeah.
in both units. Anyway, that's a very small correction, if you want to call it that.
Nice.
I had been studying Soviet politics, having done a couple of law degrees first, and I discovered when it came time to do a dissertation two things. One, my Russian was not very good, and it would take me a year to get my Russian really up to snuff. And in those days, I assure you, you really needed good Russian in order to understand the Soviet Union. And the second thing was that my dissertation advisor, Merle Feinsod, who was really the most celebrated student of Soviet politics, and justly so, was encouraging graduate students to do very narrowly conceived monographic dissertations. And I didn't want to do yet another dissertation on the Soviet factory manager and his world, or something like that.
Yeah.
As all that was floating around in my head, my wife and I went to a party for some friends who were going off on sabbatical. They were junior faculty members. A young woman at the party came up to me, and we were talking. And it turned out that she was from what was then British Guiana, which is now Guyana, on the north coast of South America. And she was telling me how the Marxists were taking it over, and that she had to carry a gun because she had been nominated, that is, an appointed member of the colonial Senate, and she wasn't in sympathy with the Marxist Party, and was very fearful that they were trying to burn down her home, which they had tried to do once, and so on and so forth. And I said, "Oh, well, wait a minute. Marxism in a developing country. Guyana was to be independent a year later. What a great topic. I know my Marxism and from Soviet politics, and all I need to do is master this developing country thing." So I went to the Widener Library, and I pulled out every book on British Guiana as at the time, and I read them throughout the evening and into the middle of the night. And by the time I was done at 3 or 4 in the morning, it became quite clear to me that this was had nothing to do with Marxism. Although, in fact, the colonial premier, the man who was going to very likely to inherit the independent position of prime minister in a future Guyanese dispensation, was indeed a Marxist, and a pro-Soviet one at that. His wife, an American, incidentally, was pro-Chinese. How they got along, I don't know. In those days, the Soviets and the Chinese were not getting along. In any case, I said, no, this is not what it's about. His party is actually a party of East Indians, that is, people who had come after the end of slavery to take up jobs as indentured laborers on sugar plantations, Guyana having been a sugar colony during the latter period of British rule. This had to do with the descendants of slaves and also people of mixed parentage who were lined up in the other party. So this was a question of ethnic politics. I'm not sure I defined it that way. I think I called it race relations at the time. But that's what it was about, for sure. And I said, now that's an interesting point. Who's what am I going to do with this? Fainside isn't going to going to advise this dissertation, but somebody told me that that a young man had just returned from a genteel exile at Columbia University, where because he had not gotten tenure, and I should go knock on his door. So I did. I knocked on his door, and I said, "Professor, you don't know me, and I don't know you, but perhaps you'd be interested in advising this dissertation." And he did what I later learned he frequently did. He was a shy man. He looked at his shoes and he said, "Sure, why not?" He said, "Of course, we'll have to send you down there." I said, "Send me down there. What for?" He said, "Field work." I said, "In the Soviet field, we don't do field work. Can't do it. What is field work anyway?" And so I realized I had a lot of quick studying to do, but he was willing to advise this, and that's how I came to be interested in ethnic politics. By the way, that man who had just come back from the genteel exile was Sam Huntington,
Oh, wow.
who was my advisor and mentor in many different ways, and I stayed in touch with him for many years. And in fact, I dedicated one of my books to him. In any case, he proved to be a very agreeable advisor. He gave me excellent advice along the way, and I did a dissertation on Guyana. Now, how did I get to comparative ethnicity? I could just have become an expert on a certain colonies, or the Caribbean or something like that. Well, as it happened, we had quite an active group of fellow graduate students, and as I was finishing my dissertation, one of them pointed out to me that Guyana had ethnically based parties, as I've mentioned to you, but actually in Malaysia, they had a multi-ethnic coalition ruling the country after independence, which it had already gained some years earlier. And I said, "Oh, that's interesting. Maybe I'll start reading up on Malaysia." So I did, and I then got it when I finished my dissertation. I got a postdoctoral fellowship. Sam Huntington added a few thousand dollars to it, so my whole family could go with me to for a year to Malaysia. And I became fascinated with Malaysian politics, which I still am to this day. I still go to Malaysia quite regularly. Well, COVID interrupted that, but typically I've made it a point in recent years to go every year for at least a couple of months. And Malaysian politics is an infinitely fascinating, although sometimes depressing, subject for study. So from there, I also stopped in Sri Lanka, and I actually ran into an accidental book project. I interviewed some coup makers who were walking the streets, which is very rare for coup makers, and published a book on an attempted coup in Sri Lanka. So I gradually expanded my horizons and to Asia and Africa overall. And well, you've seen some of the results in that book, Ethnic Groups in Conflict, that you consulted. But that's not the only one I've written on ethnicity. I've written quite a lot about ethnicity, and all because of a couple of accidents. It's really all it is. If an accident comes your way, and it looks like it's a fortuitous accident as opposed to a disastrous one, you should follow the path because it's often a worthwhile path. I should tell you, by the way, that I also, in the middle of my dissertation, I took a year off to clerk for a federal judge. I then later practiced law before I went into full-time teaching at Duke. So I've had several different careers in a certain way, and incidentally, I have a book pending, a book now in press at Oxford University Press on federalism, in which I've been able to use a lot of what I learned about the Soviet Union's ostensible federalism, which was not really a federalism at all. But the Soviet background came in very handy in this book. So
Very interesting.
you don't really lose things if you can continue to accumulate knowledge, if you're smart about adding things rather than displacing one thing with another.
That's a great point. It's a great point. And on the topic of ethnicity, I know you touched on this a little bit before, but before we discuss a bit about ethnic politics, I'm curious about your definition of ethnicity, because from what I understand, ethnicity is maybe a bit of a controversial has a controversial definition in the sense that people can't really agree on it. Is that right?
I don't follow the formal definition disputes these days. There have been some in the past,
I mean,
but
I guess the main dispute maybe is whether it's inherent in people or whether it's something we constructed. What are your views on that?
Oh, it's neither in both. Ethnicity is a putatively ascriptive affiliation. So what I mean by ascriptive is, I mean it's given at birth, but only putatively. That is to say that people can become members of an ethnic group by marriage, for example, or they can become that way by conversion into a certain religion, which happens to whose boundaries happen to be coterminous with ethnic boundaries. So it's a putatively ascriptive affiliation, and it's defined by not merely our view of ourselves, using our as the possessive pronoun for a particular collection of people, but also defined by who else is in the environment.
Interesting.
The definitions of ethnic boundaries depend very heavily on who else is in the environment, so that they can become more and less rigid depending on how relations unfold with other groups that happen to be in the same milieu. So it's both. It's both given at birth, but for most people, but then again, not for everybody. And it's also something that's imputed to people, and sometimes they accept it. There's an excellent study of ethnic politics, along, in fact, politics in the Congo in general, right around the time of independence, by Crawford Young. And it's called Politics in the Congo, oddly enough. There's a chapter in there on ethnic politics. And Crawford is really the person who, without getting credit for it, discovered the fact that ethnic boundaries can quickly change, and that superiors such as colonialists, putative superiors such as colonialists, can help define ethnic boundaries. Because in the case of people speaking a common language, in this case Lingala, the Bangala people were more or less created by Belgian administrators who said, "Look, you don't realize it, but the people in the village down the stream from you speak more or less the same language. You really have a lot in common." And so the views of these other people, that is the Belgians, during the colonial period, very much affected the self-conscious views of the Bangala people as they emerged as a single people. And indeed, in ethnic politics in the Congo, following around the time of independence and following, the Bangala people have been an important unit. But have a look at that chapter. Crawford Young was a very prominent student of ethnicity and many other things also in Africa. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us.
And on the topic of ethnicity, that you kind of discussed this, but if, you know, as you said, defining ethnicity is quite difficult. What about ethnic conflict? Do you think ethnic conflict, which we see and have seen a lot of in the past, is that inherent? Is that you know, when two ethnicities are different and for some reason they're having conflict, is that an inherent part of a relationship between two different ethnicities, would you say?
No, many ethnic groups live side by side with other groups without engaging in overt conflict. They may or may not like each other. They may find that they have a number of affinities with each other, and when they find that they have these affinities, then they certainly don't enter into conflict relations. When they find that they're both trying to grasp the same thing, on the other hand, they find they and often that's not a material thing. It sometimes just comes to down to a matter of domination, even symbolic domination. There's a lot of dispute about whose symbols will dominate the polity in a number of countries. That's when the conflict occurs. No, one shouldn't think of ethnicity as merely a conflict category. It can be a cultural category or a social category. That is to say, it defines us rather than defining rather than defining our cultural commonality. It can just define us without our having all that much in common. Often the basis for ethnicity is quite a minimal basis in cultural terms. People can speak different languages and still find themselves in the same identity category, and acknowledge that as well.
Interesting. Interesting. And kind of a follow-up to that, as you know, as we modernize and as we globalize, two words that we hear a lot of now, do you think that ethnic conflict is almost becoming non-existent or at least decreasing from what it used to be?
No, I think there's still quite a lot of ethnic conflict around the world. I wouldn't want to say that most groups who live next to other groups are in conflict relations. I think that's too hard a job to go and count them all up and figure out how many there are. No, but ethnic conflict is a fairly common phenomenon. There's plenty of material out there for those who want to study it and to figure it out and to ascertain its dimensions and its characteristics.
And kind of switching gears to your book, which we've alluded to throughout this interview. It's called Ethnic Groups and Conflict, and I'll put it in the description for those who are curious in reading it. So in your book, Ethnic Groups and Conflict, you discuss and a lot of people also discuss this the role of elites in creating ethnic conflict, and almost I think a term that I've heard used before, although maybe a little different, is ethnic entrepreneurs, kind of elites manipulating ethnicity. So do you think that this manipulation is always deliberate, or can it just be an unintended consequence of power struggles and things like that?
Yes, I wouldn't want to say it's always highly deliberate, but it's all frequently quite deliberate. But manipulation isn't always the right term for it, because quite often what elites are seizing on is something they see in the marketplace, the political marketplace. That is, there are votes in supporting one's ethnic group against other groups with whom that group has at least the beginnings of conflict relations, and maybe quite severe conflict relations sometimes. So. I'm not sure I like the word manipulation, really, because you can't manipulate something that's not manipulable. What they typically do is exacerbate conflict more than they do create it.
Interesting.
So there is a there certainly is a role for elites, and the elite and typically elites stand to gain something out of it. If it's not votes, it's money, power, and prestige. So it sometimes pays. But that makes it all the more urgent to figure out ways to mitigate that kind of reward structure for elites. And one way to do it is through interethnic coalition behavior.
So what you're saying is that these elites kind of draw on something that's already there in a sense.
Or at least latent in the environment, something they sense as it can be magnified.
Okay, interesting. And at the end you said about finding the best system, and I know this next question might be almost impossible to answer, but what are some, good systems of government that we see in ethnically divided societies, or some systems that you'd almost prescribe as solving, I put in quotation marks, an ethnically divided state?
Well, managing is probably a better word for most in most
Managing, yes,
cases,
managing, exactly.
but there's no particular single set of institutions that necessarily is better than another, depending on the circumstances. I mean, for example, a country that's used to parliamentary institutions can't easily be told, look, if you have a separation of powers, which is characteristic of a presidential system, it's inevitably going to be better for you than what you have. No, I don't think that that's the case. But what I do think is the case is that if you have incentives to behave moderately, if politicians and their followers have incentives to behave moderately because there's some rewards in doing so, and especially electoral rewards, that's a good starting point. You know, there's a very large dispute in the literature between consociationalists and centripetalists,
Yes.
and And some people think I started the centripetalist movement. They're probably right about that. In any case, I've always been in favor of incentives rather than commands. The consociational prescription has a number of attributes, about five of them, and if you follow all five, says its main progenitors and advocates, then you will be most likely to reduce conflict and be able to live together in peace and harmony. That's sometimes true and it's sometimes not true. But if you follow incentives to behave moderately, then if the incentives produce rewards, that's another course to, if not peace and harmony, at least, how shall I put it, moderating the conflict. And that's the course that I think probably is easier to attain because the consociational prescription is a very rigid one. Although Liebhardt, who is the principal proponent of it, says, no, it's not one size fits all. But if you read him carefully, you might come to a different conclusion. With the incentives view, it's really just a question of finding a way to behave moderately. And typically, what that involves is finding a way to appeal to groups other than your own. If you can find a way to do that and put together a coalition, well, it may very well be that you have the possibility of negotiating your way to something that will be relatively peaceful.
So you talked a bit about consociationalism and Liebhardt, and one question I have, and almost you I think if I'm correct, you said that in an ideal society, right, everything that consociationalism prescribes was followed, it would work, it would be successful, but the problem is doing all those things, correct?
No, I didn't quite say that. I think that sometimes the prescription is out there and you can still get conflict anyway.
Okay.
But I don't deny the fact that the societies that originated that prescription were already looking to reduce conflict and they hit upon that prescription. Well, one has to ask the question, was it their motivation that made them more peaceful when they adopted the prescription, or was it the prescription that made them more peaceful? And it's very difficult to separate the two. I don't want to pronounce on that because a lot of those countries are countries that I don't specialize in. This happened mostly in smaller societies in Western Europe, such as the Netherlands and Belgium and Austria. So it's a little bit difficult to say what really was the causal element in their success. And by the way, and it's not there's a lot of revisionist scholarship in this. Switzerland, for example, is frequently cited as a consociational society, but there is a Swiss of Bosnian extraction who came to Switzerland as a teenager, who then was educated in Swiss schools, and who is now a prominent political scientist, who has shown that a lot of Swiss institutions are actually centripetal institutions and not necessarily consociational ones. So there is going to be a very big dispute in Switzerland, intellectual dispute, I mean, about really how consociational Switzerland is. I think, and he thinks, that it's a hybrid society. That is, that the institutions are hybrid institutions.
I think that's a very interesting point, and the main idea that kind of we never, I mean, we can't really tell whether it's the system or, the want to make change that has created a less ethnically divided society. So I think that's very interesting. And moving on to something that's a bit more related to the scope of the podcast. The podcast is very diverse, but something that that maybe some viewers are more used to hearing is what. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with this, but can like tangible artifacts and monuments in an area that's ethnically divided play a role in intensifying ethnic conflict?
Can they ever? Oh, yes, indeed, they can. Someplace in that book, In Ethnic Groups in Conflict, I depict a dispute over the symbols of authority in a single African community, and how that fostered conflict. Yes, look, just think about it for a minute. If I want to put up a statue of George Washington, and you want to put up a statue of Adolf Hitler, we're likely to be fighting over this pretty quickly. And for good reason, because what your statute says is that you have a set of allegiances that's very much at odds with mine, and mine says the same thing about yours. So it's a very crisp and nice way of precipitating conflict behavior, actually.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm sure if you walk by something every day that doesn't follow your beliefs, that can certainly lead to conflicts, as you said.
Yeah.
So,
Look in the index under armorial bearings, because I think that's probably where it is in the book. There was a dispute in among African groups about armorial bearings.
Interesting.
You can find it there, and it really was a very intense dispute.
Sounds good. And one
Well,
last question.
and language too. If we speak different languages, and I want to make my language the official language and yours not the official language, well, of course we'll have a dispute, and that really is the same, this more or less in the same category, because if my language is official and yours isn't, that means that my group is official and yours isn't.
Yeah. No, exactly. A lot of, but I guess both tangible and intangible aspects can play a role in this intensification of ethnic conflict. So, one last question I have for you, and thank you again very much for coming on. But one last question I have for you is, what should we try to do moving forward? So, where should scholars and people interested in ethnicity focus their attention moving forward? If that's something you can answer. I know that's a loaded question, but.
Well, there are so many different topics. I'll tell you about something about that I think is suggestive of an answer, because it derives from the book that I've recently finished and that's in press now. This book is about federalism, regional autonomy, and ethnic conflict, because federalism is free, and even regional autonomy, where there's not a Where there's not a federal system to begin with, but where there's a unitary system that where power can be devolved to lower level units, are both recommended for severely divided societies, because they can take a lot of the pressure off the center and make people happier because they have some power in their own areas, whereas they may not have as much power as they would like to have at the central government level. And I've been a proponent of that. I think that the general point is absolutely accurate. Mind you, of course, we have to talk about particular cases when we do this,
Of course.
the title of this, that's the subtitle of the book, is Federalism, Regional Autonomy, and Ethnic Conflict. But the title of the book is The Promise and Perils of Devolution. Well, what perils are we talking about? It turns out that when you look into devolved units that are heterogeneous, that have gained a certain amount of power as a result of the devolution of power from the center, it turns out that quite a lot of these, especially in Asia and Africa, rather fewer in Europe, but especially in Asia and Africa, are filled with very ugly conflicts between the groups, each of which wishes to subordinate the other in a particular system. And it can come from any number of different sources. For example, in Nigeria, there's a clause in the constitution that inadvertently refers to, and I can give you the details why it's inadvertent, but it will take a long time to explain that to you. There's a clause in the constitution that inadvertently refers to being indigenous in a particular state. Ah, well, said some politicians. Some people don't want to put this in the Constitution, but we think it's a great idea. You know why they thought it was a great idea, right? Because they knew they would be declared to be indigenous in their particular states, and they could benefit by various methods of finding rent-seeking profits as a result of such a clause. Well, It turns out that in heterogeneous states, especially in the so-called Middle Belt, where Northern Muslims meet Southern Christians or Southerners who worship local deities, that the tremendous conflict between those two categories of groups over who's going to dominate whom, and it's what happens is that when one group gets the upper hand, it issues indigenousness certificates of indigeneity, which you need to, for example, get your child in free education, or to get a scholarship for your child, or to get a business license. But sometimes, some places, you can't run for office if you're not indigenous to the state. So this is a very, very important way of excluding other people through indigeneity. In other countries, it comes through other sources. In Ethiopia, for example, each state is to be the homeland of a particular large ethnic group, and sometimes small ethnic group actually, but mostly large ethnic group. Well, the states are heterogeneous, and the result is that this is a prescription for denying people their rights as citizens in the state, despite the fact that the Constitution also says that there should be no discrimination on grounds of ethnicity. So you see that some of these constitutional clauses are speaking with a forked tongue. And the result is something very nasty is happening. Now, you asked a question about topics. Okay, what am I saying about topics? What I'm saying is there are the conventional way of thinking about things sometimes obscures some hidden costs or some hidden benefits. And if you merely focused on the benefits of devolution for peace and conflict reduction at the central government level, and ignored what was going on in the units, you would never lay your hands on this problem. You just wouldn't be have your attention called to it. Now, it's not that nobody knows about this. It's rather it's discussed by scholars in single country studies. So studies of Nigeria inevitably deal with this, but comparative studies rarely deal with this problem, which is what made it so attractive to me when I started out on this book. So I think what I'm trying to say is different ways of looking at a problem can give you multiple opportunities for studying it. Ethnicity is not fully studied yet, believe it or not. It's very well studied, but it's not fully studied. And most of human relations is not really fully studied yet. I think there's plenty of opportunity out there for studying human relations and politics, for sure.
It's very interesting, and thank you very much for coming on. It was great to speak with you. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure.